is reconvened.
Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Thank you for waiting. The first case went a little longer than expected. We want to greet Lincoln High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Your teacher, John Schmidt, attended the 2001 Teachers Institute, and we want to bring special greetings to him. We have students from New Hope Christian. Would they stand? Thank you. It's good seeing you, too. Small in number, but strong. Thank you. These students are here with us with a special program, but we also have some surprise guests in honor of Justice Wilcox today. Justice Wilcox will be retiring from the court in this debate, whether it's July 31st or August 1, but he will be retiring. And today will be his last, if all things are as planned, his last day of oral argument. And he has some special guests here in his honor, and I'd like them to stand after I call each name. We have Jane Ann Wilcox, his wife. We've got Jennifer Curran.
Thank you.
Kerner, his daughter, and Lexi Lerner, his granddaughter. And how old are you, Lexi? Are you 8? Good. That's a very good age. And we have Anne and David Garber, Justice Wilcox's sister and brother-in-law. It's not your turn yet.
But I'm a little shocked. Yeah, I did that.
We also are joined by some of Justice Wilcox's clerks. We have Tom, and I'm well known for mispronouncing names, even of people I know, so you will forgive me. Tom Cabish, 1992-3. Patrick McBride, 95-96. Stephanie Constance, 98-99. Charles Schmidt, 2000-2001. Sarah Walkenhorst, 2002-2003. Tim Barber, 2003-2005. His present clerk, who's seated over there, James Warwin.
James Warzine.
Thank you. Justice Wilcox told us this morning in conference that he thought that we had done enough celebrating his retirement when we sat in his hometown of hometown area, I should say, where he was judge of Wautoma and Washera County. The court disagrees with Justice Wilcox. The court believes that numerous parties and numerous events should be in honor of his retirement.
I'm just looking. Did you introduce my brother-in-law and my sister, and I didn't hear it?
Yes.
I'm in shock that I don't think I
have to pay attention.
I know.
And we have Marlene, who's been a longtime judicial assistant of Justice Wilcox.
She's also retiring.
But I was drowned out by the applause. She is also retiring. The court will be very sorry to have her leave the court family. Now, Justice Wilcox, it is 11:40. Do you want to say anything?
Very little. I just wanted to, I haven't seen some of my clerks for a long time. I want to thank you very much for coming. I'm overwhelmed in my family. And the other thing is that the clerks, as we all know, are the backbone of the court. And to these people, I owe those very bright decisions that I put out. I owe to myself the other ones. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice Wilcox. Why don't we applaud him? We've applauded everybody else.
That is enough, and I'm worried that when counsel stands and applauds, someone's bound to be disappointed here. So.
Oh, if we play it right, they'll both be disappointed.
It's called a firm reverse, you know.
Okay. I am now prepared to call our second case, 04AP3033. Estate versus Leon P., and how is his name pronounced?
Slezinski
versus Lurk. We're going to hear 20 minutes from Janice Rhodes, representing Midwest Coast Transport. She has, on behalf of her client, ceded 5 minutes to David Wright, who is an amicus in this case, Assistant Attorney General representing Lurk. We'll then have 30 minutes from Matthew Beaker for Door Drill, representing the petitioner appellant. 5 minutes. Ms. Rhodes in rebuttal. Got it right? Okay. Ms. Rhodes.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning, almost good afternoon, to the court and counsel. I'm very honored to be here on this most auspicious occasion, and I'm also pleased to be here representing my client, Midwest Coast Transport. Federal law sets the bar for minimum physical qualification standards for truck drivers in interstate commerce. When those physical qualifications come to be the central issue in a Wisconsin Fair Employment Act case, how is that going to work? What are we going to do? What is the agency supposed to do? What's the hearing examiner supposed to do? What are the courts supposed to do? How do we give proper effect to the federal law in the context of the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act case? Midwest maintains in this case, in a case like this, that there can be no discrimination unless and until the United States Department of Transportation finds that the driver does measure up to the bar. And what we're asking for really is exactly what the Commission said in 1994 in the Herman versus Ort trucking
counsel,
case.
Counsel, the driver here was authorized to drive under the federal law, wasn't he?
Yes, he had a certification.
You think that that certification no longer applied because,
correct,
in your opinion, he had a medical problem that interfered with his driving?
Because the employer has the right to retest the individual.
Right. Why didn't you go to the federal government? There's a procedure for decertifying him. Why didn't you go? As I read the directions, it says applicant. It doesn't say driver. In fact, sometimes it says driver, sometimes it says applicant. So You could have gone and said, there's a dispute here. You should settle this dispute.
That is correct. It could have been done that way.
And under this statute, you have the obligation, the burden of proof, to show there's a safety violation.
Actually, Your Honor, I would maintain that you don't get to that part of the statute until you cross the bridge of the
Your position is that he had the burden of proof to make a prima facie case, and to make the prima facie case, he had to show he was certified, even though you said it was no longer in existence. That's your position.
Yes. And as to the point about why couldn't Midwest have gone to the USDOT, brought the issue, it could have. But the problem with placing that burden on the, or that requirement on the employer, is that while the matter is pending under the conflict resolution procedure at the USDOT, the driver is disqualified.
That's right.
So that would mean that the employer is, or could be imposing something very onerous on the driver, that keeping him unqualified for a longer period of time.
Well, then you're saying that you just don't want him as your driver because you think he's unqualified, but he's free to go and drive for somebody else and put the rest of us at jeopardy. Is that your position?
not that he should be putting others in jeopardy, but one of the peculiarities of the federal regulatory system, one of the reasons I think this case is hard to why there were different perspectives all the way through the litigation of this case, is that the USDOT system is very decentralized. There isn't some single entity or single office that you go to and ask, can I be qualified? It is left up to the trucking companies and drivers themselves as well to enforce the standards, because the trucking companies are required, they will suffer sanctions as well under the federal law if they put someone unqualified on the road. Now, I certainly do hear the court's point about if he's unqualified, he's unqualified, he shouldn't be driving. But in point of fact, that is the way the federal system works.
I just want to establish the procedure, because here there were three doctors involved. And basically, and then the final doctor, maybe it was Windhurst. Anyway, she was under the, first of all, I think it's your theory, and I may be wrong, that the federal law should prevail. Is that on the issue of
establishing what the qualifications
and,
are, yes.
And my question is, there are certain forms that they use that they have to check off. And when we look in the appendix, the last doctor, Dr. Windhurst, may have the wrong name, she didn't use a form. She just used a basic letter. And knowing how, governmental agencies respond, or how could she do that if you're relying on that as a accurate indication that this Mr. Leon had Wilson's disease? Is that an appropriate form, just having a letter?
That is a question that I really don't know how to answer, because I don't think the system is for non-certifications. I'm not aware of any requirement that you must fill out the form and say no. Now, for certifications, yes, because the person, the driver, actually has to carry a piece of it with him. Now, Dr. Windhorst did write in the form of an opinion letter, and I do think that that was sufficient. He was the doctor for Midwest Coast Transport, the individual who was always consulted by Midwest Coast on these issues of the federal qualifications. And the other doctors in this case, it has been alleged or suggested that there was kind of forum shopping going on here. And I, again, I don't think we get to that point because I think we have to invoke the federal conflict resolution process first. But
well, is it applicable here? You have to have a dispute between the driver's doctor and the company's doctor. The company had a doctor that said he was okay. Then the company has a doctor who doesn't fill out the form, who, according to at least the administrative law judge and the Court of Appeals, doesn't have an individualized view, but is a knee-jerk reaction to Wilson disease. Now, is there a knee-jerk reaction under federal law to Wilson's disease?
No.
Okay. So under federal law, what are the medical qualifications of this guy, right?
Pardon me?
What are the medical qualifications of this person?
In this particular instance, right. Yeah. It's not in one of the ones that are spelled out.
Right. So you've got here two doctors, one by the company, one by the driver. Both say, see him, both say he's okay. He's got Wilson's disease, but it's under enough control at the moment, right?
I'm not sure which doctors you're referring to, but essentially.
Your original doctor that examined him and the driver's original doctor that examined him. They both said he was okay. Windhorst said he wasn't.
Why don't we specify the names of the doctors?
My understanding is that when Mr. Schlesinski was hired, there was a DOT exam. That was Dr. Carlson, mid-1995. Then in March of 1996, when the driving issues came up that caused Midwest to want to reconsider this or look farther, they arranged for Mr. Schlesinski to see Dr. Shokare, a neuro-oncologist. Ironically, and this is shown in the medical records, that Mr. Schlesinski had gone to his own doctor, Dr. Eastwold, and said, I'm having this problem with my company, what should I do? And Dr. Eastwold also sent him to Dr. Shokare. So there was sort of a dual referral, but Midwest certainly was in there. And Dr. Shokare, I should back up. Dr. Carlson did fill out the DOT form some 9 months earlier. Dr. Shokare didn't write a report. He wrote his office notes, and those were sent to Dr. Windhorst, and then Dr. Windhorst wrote his letter. Then when I refer to a conflict in doctors' opinions that should have been resolved, I'm actually speaking about yet another doctor that after the company separated from Mr. Schlesinski, he went to a doctor by the name of Dr. Skinner. And that is the opinion that I'm saying is in conflict and why
the after he was fired.
Pardon me?
This was after he was fired.
Correct.
And as of what time did you have to prove that he was unable to drive? When he filed his complaint or thereafter?
No, I believe it would be at the time the job action was taken. So that would have been March of that year. He filed, I believe it was in October of the same year.
Okay, and when did Dr. Skinner give his opinion?
Within days, I believe it was April 6, April 5.
April in 1996. Okay, after he was fired.
Yes, but very close to the time. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Windhorst's opinion was March 21st, so we're very close together there.
You asked for a dismissal by Lurk, didn't you?
Yes, we made motions, yes, on the ground that, well, the, what was raised then was preemption.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be fair to say, counsel, that it was the experience of this trucking company to have a local doctor examine a driver, but generally, if not always, to refer it to the operation in South Dakota?
Yes.
Was it generally or always their practice?
That I can't, I'm afraid I actually don't know the answer to that, factually. And that was not part of the record. That was not, those issues were not.
But it is a fact when this company, in essence, hired the gentleman in the first place, Dr. I think it's Carlson,
yeah,
examined, and then that report was sent out to South Dakota.
I believe it was.
And they gave their seal of approval to him.
They did. Again, I know that, Your Honor, but I don't believe those facts are actually in the record of the Carlson opinion. I should explain, perhaps, why so little of this is in the record, because Midwest Coast did not approach the hearing as a place where it needed to establish, needed to prove up all of these facts about the medical opinions and about the accuracy of the medical opinions. It was a very sparse hearing, and of course by that time, unfortunately, Mr. Schlesinski was deceased, so his testimony was not even part of the record.
Ms. Rhodes, though, maybe I'm reading this wrong, but I'm looking at Appendix 21, the appellant's appendix, in the fair employment decision from LURC, and I see number 4, on June 20th, 1995, L.D. Carlson, M.D., examined complainant. Based on this examination, complainant was medically certified to drive in interstate commerce. MCT was aware at that time that complainant suffered from Wilson's disease. So I think it is part of the record here. We may not have the entire opinion, but we at least have this as part of the record, correct?
That is. But the fact that Midwest actually at that time also consulted Dr. Windhorst, as it did 9 months later, I don't believe that early consultation with Dr. Windhorst.
It wasn't Dr. Windhorst. It was
a PA.
Exactly.
Right. A physician's assistant.
But someone in the same operation.
Definitely.
All right.
Besides the decentralized nature of the federal system, where it gives this decision to the employer to decide for itself, to develop its own view of whether the minimum medical qualifications are met. Another reason that I think that this hasn't been an easy case is because of the way the regulation that sets forth the medical qualifications is drafted. Some of them are very specific, and numeric measurements of eyesight and so forth. So they list certain diagnoses, and then there are several of the categories, and this is where this case falls, where there is an area for medical judgment. And I think that's why one of the reasons that it looks like it's not a cut-and-dried federal rule, because there's this area of judgment in it. But in fact, under the federal regulations, that is how it is set up. And I don't think we can distinguish between the two kinds of impairments, if you will, that are talked about in the federal regulations. Somehow, the Wisconsin has to allow the process in the U.S. DOT on the issue of minimum medical qualification, it must allow that to go forward. We cannot have, not because they're not capable, they're certainly able to hear medical evidence and decide what's a good medical opinion and what it's not. But we can't have that being done by our agencies because that is not what the federal system is set up.
Well, if I can ask you about that, Ms. Rhodes, because I understand your position and that has a certain appeal to me. But when I look at 391.47, resolution of conflicts, the chief had already alluded to this before. It talks in terms of applications. But I go to sub 9E. That says that deals with petitions to review, burden of proof. I'm sorry, that's the director's. Who has the burden earlier in the proceeding? As I understood your response to the chief, either party can
initiate
this. And what that suggests to me is that if either party can initiate a proceeding when there is a conflict about qualifications, it would seem to suggest, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it would seem to suggest that therefore the DOT certification remains in place until the process begins. Am I wrong?
It's 3E, I think, that you're looking at.
Thank you, Chief.
It's on page, I may not have the right number either, and I apologize to you because it's peculiarly numbered, but it's at appendix 117 is what I think you're looking at of the blue brief. Petitions to review, burden of proof, but that may be the ultimate petition to review.
That was the one I had before.
Proceeding on the petitioner. So either one can do there. The applicant must submit proof that there's a disagreement. That's under subsection 2.
And my question is,
until the process is initiated to resolve the conflicts, it would seem to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that the driver remains certified under the federal system. And if the driver remains certified under the federal system, then how did we get to the point where the driver was precluded from driving?
Because as between a specific trucking company and a specific driver, a driver may say, hey, I'm qualified. I have my DOT cert from, you know, a year ago. I was good then. The thing lasts for 2 years unless intervening events. But the employer can say, I also have an obligation under the federal statutes to ensure that every single day you drive, you're qualified. My opinion is, as of today, you're not.
And given that conflict, and this goes to the ultimate question, then does the employer have a responsibility to bring this matter in under 391.47 and initiate an application that would disqualify the driver until the conflict was resolved?
If the court wants to draw a distinction, perhaps, between legal responsibility and moral responsibility, maybe they should, morally, maybe they should. But there is actually nothing in the federal regulations that require a company that is of the view that they've got an medically unqualified driver. Nothing requires them to raise those issues.
State law applies as to who has the burden to go to the Federal Department of Transportation. You're in the state. You're accused of violating a state law. Your defense is he's not qualified under DOT. Maybe the burden is on, you say it's on the driver because it shows he has to do that to make a prima facie case. The other way of saying it, the burden on you because you have the defense of safety.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I see that my time is expired.
Your answer, yes, Your Honor, that I stated it, the two burdens correctly, or that it's time for you to leave.
Yes.
Well, I hope I wasn't planning on leaving entirely.
Well, both.
No, I think you have stated it could be either way, but the reason I don't feel that it should be placing the burden on the employer is because of the fact that the employee then it is clear that the certification is up in the air.
Right. And because that's specifically in the rules of the feds. Once this comes to them, once the dispute's there, he is unqualified for the moment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Which is why you fired him. David Rice, Assistant Attorney General, representing Lurk.
May it please the Court. This is the second time I've been before the Court on a disability discrimination case in the last two oral argument sessions of the Court. And both cases bear the similarity and demonstrate, I think, how careful you have to be in drafting an administrative agency decision or in drafting a judicial opinion, and how even the slightest misstatement can come back to haunt you and perhaps alter the proceedings entirely. I don't know if it's because a law clerk drafted it or because a justice drafted it, but in both cases, in Stoughton Trailers, for instance, there was a relatively simple case of an accommodation and whether the employer gave the employee enough time to accommodate or to comply. And yet, because of a statement in the commission's decision about if this was only one instance out of many instances, would it be because of discrimination within the meaning of the statute, which occupied a whole bunch of time in this court, and yet, in my view, was kind of an off issue. In this case, the significant issue was whether the employer was able to establish that the employee was not able to safely operate a vehicle, could not do his job. That's the simple fair employment issue. And there's another part of that. In making that demonstration, the employer has to have a doctor make a individualized evaluation as opposed to a generalized evaluation. So those were the issues the commission was supposed to decide. The commission decided that the employer had made a sufficient showing, that the Dr. Windhorst statement was sufficiently individualized, and should have stopped at that point, and then the case would have been over and we probably wouldn't have been here. But instead they went on to say that if the employee, if Slezinski didn't like the opinion of Dr. Windhorst, well, he could have gone and challenged it under federal procedures. And they also then cited the Herman case, where they earlier had dismissed a case because an employee hadn't done that. Well, that comment and the Herman decision do reflect the legitimate concern expressed by this court in Frito-Lay, well, actually by the Court of Appeals in Frito-Lay, which this court affirmed by an equally divided court, which is that there's a potential for inconsistent rulings where the federal agency would say that a driver was unqualified to drive, and yet on the administrative record before the commission would say the employer failed in its burden and ordered the person to drive. And so to avoid that conflict, there has to be a way of resolving it. Now, as Justice Abramson pointed out, we're really speaking kind of hypothetically here, because if the company had challenged his ability to drive in the federal forum and had sought a stay before the state proceeding, that's really the way these cases should be resolved.
The company's burden.
I think the company, the company certainly has the burden in the state proceeding. I'm not certain as to who has the burden to initiate the federal.
But to get out of we're talking about how the company gets out of the state proceeding.
Right. Now, it could be that it's the employee's burden, or it could even be the commission's burden or the examiner's burden. Maybe the examiner or the commission could recognize the potential for a conflict here and say, we're going to stay this proceeding so that either of the parties can apply to have this issue resolved.
But no one did that.
But no one did that here. So that's what I mean. I think in a certain sense we're talking hypothetically here. But the commission statement, and let me just say clearly, I think Herman's wrong insofar as it says that the case should be dismissed while those remedies are being sought. I think the case should be stayed because otherwise the person would have to come back and refile and the statute of limitations might have run, and that would be prejudicial to the complaining party. Now, the commission's statement here, though, and which ultimately got us here, was compounded by the decision of the Court of Appeals, because in its decision, instead of simply saying they didn't have to exhaust this process because it was inapplicable in this case because you had two doctors for the same entity, And that's one of the issues that's before you that these parties are disputing and which the commission takes no position on. The Court of Appeals went
further. Why not? Because we didn't ask you to, or you don't want to?
Well, the commission didn't appeal in this case because they thought that that might be one of the primary issues, and it really is not an agency with any expertise to offer to the court a resolution one way or the other.
But because it's a federal question as to whether anyone had the right to go to the federal administrative procedure here because of whether there is or isn't a dispute between the doctors.
Right.
Okay.
We don't take a position on whether there's a federal dispute assisted procedure available on the facts of this particular case.
Mm-hmm. If there is no dispute available, resolution available in the feds under this case, that's the end of that. You follow what the commission said.
Yes.
Or what the Court of Appeals said, in effect.
I see my time has run, but I wanted to make one more point, if I might.
Continue.
The Court of Appeals, in its decision, could have simply said that the federal procedure doesn't apply here. But they went on to say that there's no statutory requirement of exhaustion, so it would be inappropriate for the commission to require exhaustion. That's a statement which, I think they made unnecessarily. My primary purpose for being here this morning is to ask, when you write your opinion, that you address and reverse that concept. Just because the statute doesn't expressly provide for a stay to require exhaustion doesn't mean that you can't require exhaustion. Otherwise, all of your opinions where the courts have required exhaustion would be a nullity because there's nothing in the Administrative Procedure Act, for instance, that requires exhaustion.
Well, exhaustion is usually a doctrine, as I think you point out and others, where the court says you can't come here to the court because you haven't gone through the administrative process. Here, the issue is between two administrative processes.
Right.
Who finishes up first? Right? I mean, that's what the issue is here. It's not quite the usual exhaustion doctrine.
True.
And you don't think it's a preemption doctrine, as I understand your brief.
Well, I think it ultimately is a question of preemption because, as this Court has said, if the federal government determines that he's not qualified to drive,
we can't reach
a contrary result.
It's not a preemption in terms of recognizing the federal certification and recognizing the state Fair Employment Act. Both can be recognized and harmonized here.
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you.
May I ask?
Justice Prosser.
There are multiple different conditions that appear to disqualify someone as a driver. Does the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act apply to hiring decisions, too?
To hiring decisions, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Now, for example, certain kinds of diabetes where an individual is taking insulin on a regular basis, I think that is a blanket disqualification. Is that correct?
I believe that's true on the record under federal law.
All right. So if I had that condition and I went to Midwest and I went through their medical screening process, and the doctor said, "You have diabetes mellitus. We can't hire you." What about can I file some sort of discrimination claim at that point?
Well, I think you certainly can file the discrimination claim, but I think it would be ultimately rejected. And there would be a finding of no discrimination because the employer would be able to sustain its burden of showing that the person couldn't safely perform or adequately perform their job duties. What's difficult about this case is that Wilson's disease is not expressly addressed in the regulation. You do have the conference report from many years earlier in which the experts that participated in that report thought that that should be an automatic disqualification. But the U.S. Department of Transportation never changed a regulation to adopt the findings of that report. I think that, as I said in my brief in the Court of Appeals in this case, I think the commission was persuaded by the fact that there had been this report.
Okay. Now, if you lose certain limbs, you're also going to be disqualified. Is that correct?
I believe so. I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I mean,
in Boynton Cab Company, there was a driver who only had one arm, and the company relied on federal regulations, but because he wasn't subject to those regulations, it didn't apply. But I think you're right. I think that it's a disqualification.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is the burden of proof that the Chief Justice has addressed. If we have a driver who somehow, I don't want to say through. No, let's say the driver is perfectly legitimately hired, but develops one of the conditions where there's a blanket rule. Once that's determined by the company that this driver just doesn't qualify under the blanket rule, I can't imagine that the company has the burden of taking that to the Department of Transportation to establish that.
I wouldn't think they would have to go to the Department of Transportation. Establishes
a matter of law.
I think it's established as a matter of law, and then in the agency proceeding before the state agency, I think the employer would prevail, relying on that mandatory disqualification.
It's the employee would come in and say, "I'm disabled, and I was fired." Company comes in and says, "Yes, because it's a safety issue, because under federal law, you have lost your license because you have one of these diseases that absolutely disqualifies you." Is that the way you see it?
The agency should dismiss the complaint on that basis.
Counselor? On the basis of the facts set forth.
Does it also affect the employee's prima facie burden of proof on showing that he is qualified, because you have to have a DOT certification or you just can't get to first base?
Well, under federal law, that's certainly the case, because under federal law, you're not disabled unless you're qualified.
Right.
Under the ADA.
Under the ADA, and okay. The Harris case and others are cited.
How do you think that fits in Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin, at least to this point, the Wisconsin courts have construed it differently. They've said the burden rests on the employee to show that I'm disabled and that I've had an adverse employment action, but then that the burden shifts to the employer to show that the person's not qualified.
It was a bona fide reason for the action. Mm-hmm.
That's established in prior cases.
Yes.
Just as possible.
Where does the employee show that the employee is disabled?
That's at the very beginning of the case. The employee has to show that they have a physical or mental impairment which substantially...
But where?
You mean in what form?
In the complaint, in the allegations?
Oh, it has to be beyond the allegations. At the hearing, they have to present evidence. And more recent cases of the Court of Appeals have found that the employer has not met the employee has not met his or her burden of establishing disability. A person, for instance, could have migraine headaches, but it wouldn't limit their capacity to work. And in that sense, they're not disabled.
What your view is that Wilson's disease is a disability compared to migraine?
From what I read from the record, I would believe that it was a disability.
That was not an
but
issue.
But it wasn't placed an issue in this case, okay. So I'm not certain.
Was not an issue. The issue came whether there was a good defense.
There was essentially a concession on the employer's part that the person was
disabled
and that they were terminated, and the question was whether or not the employer had permission to do that because the person couldn't drive safely.
I have one last question. It's my understanding that there is a provision of the Code of Federal Regulations dealing with commercial driver's licenses that authorizes a trucking company to set medical standards higher than the standards set by the federal government. How does that square with the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act?
Well, I think you would try to harmonize that federal regulation and the state statute, if possible. But I assume that your question presupposes there could be a conflict between the employer adopting higher standards. And then I think the question is, whether the state agency would find that the employer had failed in its burden of proof because they hadn't established that the person couldn't do their position with that condition, and secondly, whether the federal regulation would somehow preempt, which would seem to me a question of federal preemption doctrine. And a court might well hold that the standards authorized by the federal government and adopted by the employer would preempt. But that's a question of preemption law that I'm not certain of, because it's not a direct conflict between a specific federal provision and a state outcome, but between something that's authorized by a federal regulation and a state outcome. And without looking into that, I'm hesitant to offer an opinion on
all that. You're in a situation where the federal authorizes the employer to do it, but the state statute says no.
Right.
And then that the question is whether or not they are inconsistent and the feds take over, or whether the Fed says, in effect, you are authorized to do higher standards unless the state provides otherwise.
And that's why I'm hesitant to take a position, because I don't know the answer to that.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Counsel, it's now 12:20. I've got a court where at least some members become very grouchy if they don't eat. And so we have a 1:30 case. So I'm going to do the following. I'm going to ask that you all take a lunch break, and that you come back, if you would, at 1:30, and we will hear